financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vaunting. You're listening to the Vaunting Podcast.
And welcome to the Vanu Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. I'm Kyle, and
I'm Shane. Since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, this podcast and everything found on the website is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse and modification to anyone except for governments and the bludgies thereof. And as always, we do highly recommend and suggest that you share this podcast and any of these articles anywhere, mirror anywhere you absolutely want to. We absolutely love that, as long as you're not a bludgy. And if you are, then I don't know why you're listening to this podcast, but there you go.
So, Shane, how are things going on in your corner of North America?
Oh, going well. I'll be heading down south, not to the property. In the middle of the woods, but actually, I don't know if I mentioned this on this podcast before, but my dad's working on opening up a distillery there in Southern Illinois, and going to be heading down there on Saturday. He's apparently the guy who's making the still and the mash tuns. Apparently, he's got those done, so we're going to go in and get those installed. So it's a pretty exciting step forward. We're going to start making liquor here, probably at the beginning of 2018.
That definitely sounds good. I'm really happy for you that getting that kind of small business kind of up and running and such. Yeah. It's kind of interesting in some kind of sad ways too. In my own pursuit of financial independence, I apparently working at a warehouse for about $300 a week ain't gonna cut it. So
nope.
So what's been interesting, though, is that there have been some coworkers of mine that see how I work, and they've basically been offering me jobs. So basically, I've got a rush of job applications I'm filling out tomorrow and day after, as well as some potential interviews that are going to be lined up next week. So cross your fingers that I can actually reduce my hours at the warehouse. And by the way, as far as like how the company works, apparently you can be scheduled up to 35 hours a week maximum. But of course, if you get there half an hour early, work half an hour late, and or asked to work one additional hour later because somebody else didn't show up for their shift, you can work up to 39 hours per week, but obviously not to 40 because of labor laws and such, right? Because then there's additional issues with the bludgies and their laws and such. But what's interesting is that on the flip side of that, you can work as little as 10 hours a month. So there's people who like maintain employment by just like work just on one day a month, 10 hours at the warehouse.
I wonder if some of those folks are the ones that, pull, disability or welfare or something, that they can only work up to a certain amount.
Yeah, I think there's I think there's that too. So maybe some welfare statism gaming the system that way, in a manner of speaking. I think there's probably a lot of that too. But I've even talked with a few of them, and not to belabor the point too long, but there are some folks who are basically using the warehouse job kind of as their fallback in case something falls through with what they're actually working on.
Of course.
So they don't really have a lot invested. They just do the most menial of grunt work, not even the nicer work assignments I'm now getting because I've proven myself over these past several months to my bosses and such.
They aren't looking for advancement or anything. They're doing as little as they possibly can to keep the job, and that's all they really care about.
Right. And if they need to up the hours just so that they can have something to tide them over while they're job hunting and getting something else, then obviously they'll up their hours, at their own convenience. But otherwise, they're going to be part of what the older, more experienced employees who do try to treat it as a regular job as best they can, even though it's legally considered part time, is that they now call it the 10-hour a month club. So there's kind of
what benefits come from that?
Oh, the benefits that come from that is that you get to maintain employment at the warehouse job as a fallback, but
well,
you
right,
have
right.
some
well, yeah.
time. So you basically earn your $105 a month, and then you're doing something else with your life the other 29, you know, days of the month.
Fair enough. I was being kind of sarcastic. What benefits does that club have with it?
Well, you know, I get what you mean. But it's also interesting too, because some of the more curmudgeon older employees have considered the 10 hours a month club to be the only real notion of promotion, because there is a lot of nepotism in terms of becoming an assistant manager and so forth, not based on merit, not based on competency. Even the last guy who was hired was is incompetent. But at least he, unlike the former new guy who now has got a slight promotion of sorts, and is now, oh yeah, he's slightly experienced now, therefore he has to give him deference. There's all sorts of office politics going on even between the assistant managers, not counting, you know, people in my position or role or whatever. So it's been more fun for me just to kind of look at this portion of the Servile Society's people trying to treat it like a career, and I'm just laughing my butt off. Seriously, it's like, wow, they're taking this way too seriously and doing way too much office politics to try and kind of screw each other over. I mean, it's amazing. And that's before even getting to the competency issues.
Right.
But yeah,
no, I've definitely known some folks like that where if they spot a mistake, like typically with some of the places I've worked, if you make a mistake, some other people, like most other people, will just correct it. And then just, you know, maybe they might come up to you after and say, hey, you know, you messed up on this, just to let you know. And then there are those people that actually email the supervisors like, hey, so-and-so made a mistake. And they like bring it directly to the attention of the supervisor, the ones that are like, you know, I caught this mistake. Those sorts of folks, where it does kind of, you know, end up at, and sometimes, you know, hurting you, the one that he kind of snitched on, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I definitely know what you mean there.
But because the opportunities for promotion are basically closed, even to the people in my position who've worked at the warehouse for like 2 years plus, who actually are more competent than most of the assistant managers. But again, if it was a meritocracy, they would be assistant managers by now. But because it's based on nepotism and who you know, not what you know, that kind of shows the values that are rewarded. Which is rather unfortunate. And that's just kind of where it is. So that's why the older, more experienced employees that know how to make that place work and are paid my same base pay, even though I've been there a lot shorter, or at least not as long, they've been saying that, well, I guess the only real opportunity for advancement in this place is to join the 10-hour-a-month club, meaning you still maintain employment there legally as a fallback, but what you're really doing is using...
Pursuing other opportunities then.
And you're actively job hunting and you're actively sending out resumes and going on job interviews and you're actively doing that and then, you know, one day a month you show up at the warehouse, you do, you know, they're whatever, and you try to stay away from management as much as you can. Sometimes it's impossible, but other days it's, you know, there have been days where I haven't seen any of the assistant managers for like, I remember one time, 7 hours straight, no breaks, no lunch or anything. I was just working. I'm fine because I've just gotten used to it. I went to the bathroom once that particular day, but I never saw a manager. And I have to say that was one of my nicer shifts or nicer work days when I didn't actually have to deal with management at all for that long a period, because usually I have to deal with management like about once an hour.
Right.
Or once every 3 hours, depending on the task I'm doing. But 7 hours without dealing with management, oh, just dealing with my coworkers. Some are okay and others not so okay, but even the not so okay ones, I can basically blow them off and there's no repercussions.
Yeah.
So I guess there's all of that, but yeah, I to be perfectly honest, I'm getting tempted by the 10-hour-a-month club, and I'm not going to do that yet. I'm going to kind of see how these other opportunities pan out first, and then we'll see. But you know what? I'm really happy for you, Shane, that business is starting to kind of go through. It's about time.
Yeah, and it's still gonna be a couple years until it's actually open to the public. But because what a lot of distilleries do, and there actually aren't that many in Illinois, especially I guess south of the central portion. So there might be one, you know, 50 or 75 miles away, but that's still, you know, quite a wide market. But what most of the distilleries do is they start out with just you know, non-aged bourbon and vodka and stuff, But what we're gonna do is we're gonna have two year aged, you know, whiskey when we open. So we're gonna be ahead of the game there. But I understand why the other distilleries do that. I mean, you're sitting on you put a lot of money into, you know, the entire business, and you want to get some money back out of it, you know, as soon as you can. You don't want to have stuff sitting in barrels for 2 years before you open. So I guess, you know, luckily we're able to do that. So it might put us a little bit ahead of the competition, but yeah, you know, I'm pretty excited for it, because one thing I've noticed is over the past, you know, few years of doing podcasting and such, I've learned a lot about advertising and marketing, but you know what I don't have? A college degree with that. So I can't, any sort of business without that sort of advertising and marketing degree, or even, you know, basically, you know, website development. So like my dad doesn't really he doesn't know a whole lot about like social media marketing and website development. So I don't need a degree to do that there. So I'll get to, get my feet wet and actually have, you know, quite a bit of money to work with, you know, advertising and marketing wise. So that'll be, it'll be fun. It'll be fun. New experience.
That's good. That's good. Well, to kind of roll on forward here, this episode is entitled Avenging Angels, Counter-Attacking the State. And the show notes can be found at vanupodcast.com/28. So this discussion will be part one of two on the topic. This coming Sunday's episode of Liberty Under Attack Radio will be part two. That website is libertyunderattack.com. Reason being, as has been the case for season two, we are only covering what Rayo had to say about these various strategies. However, in the LUA episode, we will expand upon these subjects and talk about things like assassination politics, vigilantism, etc. So again, that website is libertyunderattack.com, and you can subscribe to that podcast on all the same podcatchers as you can for TVP. So, anything else before diving into it, Shane?
Not really. I just want to briefly mention, I guess, additionally, why we're doing it in this manner. Because we could just save it for season three, but Kyle and I were talking about this episode, and we figure it'd be, you know, good. I mean, I'm pretty sure most of the listeners of TVP, at least, you know, a good number of them are from LUA, but I don't know how much that reciprocates. So I want to get some traffic flowing in between the podcasts, which I wasn't going to do initially, but I don't see why not. So I guess. Well, yeah, we'll go ahead and do that.
Right, it's a ripe opportunity, correct?
Yeah, and plus, you know, I find these subjects so intriguing, and you know, there's a lot of possibilities that could stem from it, which you'll find out in this next edition of Liberty Under Attack Radio. But I don't want to wait till season three to discuss these things. I want to kind of do it, you know, all at once. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and before we head into the definitions, one comment I will make about this before I forget. You know, people really need to, especially in the alternative media, really need to seriously, as adults, talk about use of force issues and do so with really any measure of integrity. So many people will appeal to the non-aggression principle, but they won't actually try to apply it. And so it's very interesting that there are certain celebritarians and others, and there's a long history about certain case studies and certain organizations and individuals and such, where they will try to address use of force issues at least at one point, and then they will completely trash their integrity at some later point. And then, of course, the critics come along and say, well, see, you know, XYZ person, you know, John Doe, was talking about use of force issues, and then 5 months later, he's now some sort of, you know, nasty authoritarian status type.
Now he's talking about wanting to throw commies out of helicopters is kind of the one sort of example or possibility.
And if not that particular case study, whose name shall not be repeated, yes, that's kind of the point, right?
So that could be, you know, a handful of people, but yeah, go ahead.
sure. There's one in particular I'm thinking of. But yeah, the point being is that we need to be able to discuss use of force issues and not be scared by authoritarians or just more moderates who get scared about talking about anything beyond so-called gun rights or so-called gun control, which really is a rather limited scope of debate. You know, I'm more concerned about under what conditions do you need to kill a cop under? That would be like a much more important question to ask rather than, you know, should this particular type of rifle be banned under these conditions? That doesn't concern me. What concerns me is, with whatever tools and or weapons you have at hand, even if it's just a sharpened pencil, you know, under what conditions should you injure and or kill someone? And then what types of someone's, and then what types of conditions? And then that's actually applying the non-aggression principle. So it's getting away from so-called gun politics in the mainstream sense and really dealing more with how far can you stretch out the applicability of the non-aggression principle without actually violating it? And if it does come to a point of violating it, where roughly is that line? And that's actually a lot more interesting to me and should be more interesting to libertarians in general. So just please, for the listeners, please keep that in mind as we go through this episode. You know, please keep the nap very much in the foremost of your thoughts. So, Shane, since you are the definition man this time, please tell everyone who is an avenging angel.
Right. So this is I think this was the term that Rayo used. But it's so an avenging angel can be defined as an individual who is contractually obliged to carry out selective counterattacks on behalf of a victim who cannot stop it once it has begun. This agreement must be kept secret to prevent intimidation by the state and is intended to deter the state from harassing libertarians using Pavlovian psychology. So that's what it is. That's what it is, and as we hear what Rayo had to say, we'll find out exactly how he kind of wants to apply this and how it could work. But certainly an interesting concept.
Well, if you don't mind, let's take a few minutes and just kind of unpack that definition, because there was a lot being said there. So the angel in question has to be someone who is contractually obliged to carry out these counterattacks on behalf of someone else who can't even stop it. Once they've kind of – so it's almost like a dead man switch in some sense, I think, is what's kind of being described here.
Right. So John Libertarian signs a contract with Jane Libertarian and says, hey, here's a bunch of money. You know, if I get locked up, you know what to do with it. I don't tell anybody about it is kind of the idea here. It's to, provide, selective counterattacks against the state to make it less attractive to, molest libertarians or harass libertarians. So that's kind of the idea here. And using Pavlovian psychology, I think Rayo says something along the lines of, and we'll obviously get to this, but make it cost a lot for them to do it, and they'll stop harassing libertarians. Which I don't know, I'm not sure about that, but we'll obviously get more into that.
Yes, and as we are about to dive into these direct quotes, just for the listeners, please keep in mind one particular way this could work is on behalf of political prisoners. Just something just to kind of keep there in your cerebral cortex, so to speak.
As a more concrete example, too, for the folks that would be for some of the folks like the Silk Road guys, or I guess the deep web folks more generally, or even folks who may set up assassination markets in the future, assassination politics markets. This could be an interesting I guess application of that as well. So.
Sure. So let's get to what Rayo had to say. So here's our first quote. Quote, deterrence. A system relying mainly on deterrence tends to be unstable and result in mutual destruction, unprofitable to all parties. Its instability stems from the advantages of landing the first blow. One example is the balance of terror among nuclear weapon states, which may break down at any time with catastrophic results. Another more relevant to us might be a band which camps openly, allows their location to become public knowledge in the national forests, and tries to keep the bludgies, pigs, at bay by threatening to burn the woods. This might work for a while, but would result sooner or later, I suspect, in burned forests and imprisoned band members. As black militants have shown, deterrence is valuable, perhaps necessary, but only as a supplement to other protection means, close quote. So that almost sounds like a version on a theme of a standoff, doesn't it, Shane? Or am I misunderstanding something here?
I suppose, yeah, that does sound, that sounds right. Let's look at, I don't know what the Bundy standoff or the Malheur Wildlife Refuge standoff, is there any way that could be applied here? I don't know if there's really, much deterrence. I think that was just open defiance. I don't think there was really much
deterrence. Well, sorry to interrupt, but think about the when it comes to, okay, like the actual examples Rayo used here, the balance of terror amongst nuclear weapon states. Well, governments have nuclear weapons, or at least many of them do. That means they actually have power to murder many foreigners of the other nation state or whatever, right? There's actual power there. The other example about threatening to burn down the woods, those individuals who are threatening to burn down the woods, I would assume have access to at least matches and gasoline and whatever else they need to commit arson. So there's actual power behind that. So with regards to the Malheur fiasco, which, of course, if people want to learn more about that, I think there's articles on the Liberty Under Attack website where you and I co-wrote at least one article about that.
Correct.
In detail, especially concerning the Harney County Committee of Safety and everything related to that, because that was another aspect of it regarding what had happened during the events at Malheur. I don't know, man. There's no power there. So there was
no threat either. I mean, it was just people who were openly carrying I guess depending upon, you know, what they were saying one day, whether it was to get the Hammonds out of prison or if it was to return the so-called public lands from the BLM to the states. I mean, there wasn't really any deterrence there anyways. It was just kind of open defiance. I mean, if they would have said something on the line, like to compare it to Rayo's example here, if they were to just, you know, stay there openly and threaten to, I mean, there's not really a forest there. It's just kind of open, right? I don't know what their threat could have been.
There wasn't one, considering this. I mean, not to get too deeply into the Malheur issue, because that would easily be its own episode on probably on LUA or elsewhere. But suffice it to say for here, there was no deterrence because they had no power, as was the case with the Harney County Committee of Safety specifically, but also, you know, the C4CF guys themselves, who are the actual people at the refuge doing the bravado routine one more time. Now, they didn't have any power.
There would be deterrence in the Bundy standoff, though, right? Because it was you have the nuclear weapons on both sides of the states. On that mm-hmm. in that one, you had, you know, guns on both sides. You had the Patriots, and then you had the government, and the idea was to deter them from, you know, taking cattle and taking land. So that might actually be a pretty good application of deterrence, is deterring the state from, you know, harassing the Patriots, harassing the Bundys. So that might actually be an example of, you know, of real world case study of where this deterrence was actually put into play. What do you think?
Well, remember what Ryan Payne admitted later, that he lied about all of that. So it's kind of like, okay, so which
Hold
version
on,
are we
and
going
for,
to believe?
For the listeners that may not know about that, what did Ryan lie about?
Ryan Payne basically claimed that, the official story was that there were, you know, the militia snipers aiming at the evil Fed goons. And then much, much later, Ryan Payne admitted that, well, I lied about that. There were no militia snipers. It was all bluff and bravado and psyop type stuff against the Fed goons. And so it's like, okay, so what version are we supposed to believe? Are we supposed to believe the mainstream version, which does say that there were so-called snipers aiming at federales, or are we going to believe Payne's confession that he lied? Now, me personally, I would take Payne at his word, but many people aren't because they prefer the official story. So at that point, it's just kind of like...
So would that take it out of the realm of deterrence then, since there wasn't, I guess, that kind of equal force?
If you believe Ryan Payne, then yes, it would, as I do. I don't think there was any deterrence there if he's actually telling the truth this time around. Because remember before, he admitted he lied the first time. Because remember, he was supposedly in charge, or at least coordinating, or whatever the vague descriptors are, because, you know, he was pretending to be whatever the militia liaison, I think, was the official term for the Bundy family or whatever the hell. I mean, look, I mean, at some point we'll need to do an LUA episode about like the Patriot movement in general, because they've done this kind of stuff before. The long and short of it, though, is that regarding examples, actual case studies of deterrence, I think Rayo's examples are way better here.
Yeah.
The reason being, relative to the Patriot movement, is because Rayo's examples, there's the parties in question have actual power where they can actually kill each other. The Patriot movement, there's nothing like that. It's all like very flashy, almost commercialized in some ways. as in buy a gun today because the government may steal it tomorrow, but don't actually use it, because using it would be an actual use of power. It would also be use of force as well. But no, it's just the shiny trinket. It's just the superstitious amulet that'll keep the Fed goons at bay, because that's how the Patriots actually, you know, act and think. I should know. But again, that's a topic for another time. What I'm trying to say here is I think Rayo's examples here about the balance of terror among nuclear weapon states and like random people in national force threatening to burn it down, I think are much more realistic examples, because both parties at play, all parties at play, have actual power to affect each other, whether for good or for ill.
Right. Yeah, I think Rayo's examples are a lot better. Yeah, those ones. I don't think there's really a clear. Yeah, I can't think of any clear cut example of that. So yeah, I think we'll stick with Rayo's examples here and move forward.
Sure. So next quote. Quote, the self-liberator has tactical advantages over a would-be insurrectionist of any brand. The political crusader who wants to take over or destroy a state seriously threatens the rulers and will bring strong countermeasures. But the libertarian who is satisfied to coexist in protracted conflict with the state is merely an annoyance. The more astute ruler is aware, as is the libertarian, that most people are sheep and will remain sheep no matter how the libertarian lives. Of course, the statist would still rather squash the libertarian if this were easy. So libertarian tactics must be such as to make counterattacks ineffective and prohibitively costly, close quote. All right, so the next quote we'll get into more of the methodology here, but this particular one is the setup for it. That's kind of like the more philosophical basis behind it. And I still, as a side note, I love the descriptor of a would-be insurrectionist of any brand.
Right. I mean, yeah, and I love this. I love this because obviously there's, you know, to each his own, right? I mean, some people, you know, do want to have that that direct conflict with the state, but those are the people that are more often than not the ones that end up in a cage. Whether it's there was the James Baker guy up in Michigan, him and his cohort or him and his buddy, who decided to, you know, walk into a police station armed with AR-15s, like dressed in all black, really sketchy. really sketchy. Yeah, they end up in a cage. Then you have kind of the cop blockers. I mean, it's obvious. If you're gonna directly confront the state, then you know they're going to that definitely threatens them. But if you're like say Rayo, and it's, you know, that state, that's they're gonna exist. I'm just gonna become invisible to them. Obviously, the state knows that there's some of those folks out there, but. They've got enough to deal with, right? I mean, you consider, mass mass shootings. You have protests happening every single freaking day. It seems like you have. Well, they still have to, you know, do their ruling too. They have to, you know, go through their rituals. So yeah, they're not gonna. I mean, that if you go down the list of priorities, someone like Rayo is so far down the list that they don't even really come into play. But if it's someone, if it's, you know, people directly confronting the state. You know, like even like a, maybe say the Malheur Wildlife Refuge situation up there in Oregon, that's going to draw a lot of attention, and they have to quell that dissent.
Yeah, and just in the interest of kind of going after the entire left right paradigm, let's not limit ourselves to the so called right wing. Even something like Occupy Wall Street. Ooh, remember those people back in 2011? Sounds like ancient history, right? 2011, Occupy Wall Street. Wall Street's evil. Let's petition Congress to somehow abolish Wall Street, which actually would have been interesting if political crusading actually worked. But I guess Occupy Wall Street, you know, the people in that park or whatever, I guess they would be insurrectionists of any brand too, right? Because a lot of them were Rastafarian socialists.
To some extent, yeah, yeah.
And much like the guys at Malheur, much like the C4CF guys, the Occupy Wall Street people kept their demands and their goals were kind of vague and ambiguous at best, right? At least to some extent. You know, did they want regulations over Wall Street? Did they want to abolish Wall Street? Did they just want to get their student loans forgiven? I don't know, and I don't particularly care, because they changed their story every single time they got in front of a camera, and that is the reality of it.
Right, right. So the idea here, and this is obvious coming from Rayo after, you know, this many episodes of the podcast, but the idea is to lay low. It's not to directly confront the state. As he said in other places, if your state of anchorage becomes intolerable, don't extend and protracted conflict with it. Just, you know, set sail for sunnier waters. So the idea is to lay low, not to draw a shit ton of attention by having a pot, like advertising a pot rally on Instagram up there in Philadelphia, wherever the hell that happened. The idea is to lay low.
Right. And obviously, if the listeners want more details on political crusading or what I think is kind of the underbelly behind the would-be insurrections of any brand like controlled schizophrenia, please see the season one episodes of those different names. So let's get to our last quote here, which actually gets to the meat of the Avenging Angels. Quote, "One simple retaliatory mechanism is available right now to many libertarians. An individual puts part of his savings in a cash or Swiss account accessible to a friend and makes the following agreement. If he is arrested, so long as he remains incarcerated, his friend each month withdraws a certain sum and spends this for whatever will cause the offending governmental agency maximum annoyance and disability. If the individual should be executed, all of his earmarked savings are so expended. This friend is contractually obliged to carry through the retaliation, even if the victim cannot stop it while incarcerated. This prevents possible intimidation should the agreement be found out. This agreement is presumably kept secret. The agency and the individual bureaucrats would, however, be told for what they were being punished. It would be pointed out that their victim was not only minding his own business, but was acting in accordance with clear-cut moral principles, that he was not merely a common criminal, one of the herd gone astray. Through such a retaliatory arrangement, the victim not only increases chances for release, but gains a certain satisfaction. So long as he remains in jail, what better use could he make of his savings? Whether or not such retaliation should be limited to legal activities is beyond the scope of this letter." Close quote. Okay, so obviously there's a lot of details in there, so let's kind of take this kind of step by step. So much like in the definition we gave at the beginning,
right?
So the context of this is, let's just go ahead and just say political prisoners, because that's more or less what Rhea was kind of getting at here. So while you're in the big house, so to speak, the Avenging Angel withdraws a certain sum and spends this, which would ever cause the bludgies annoyance and disability. Now, I guess there's some inferences Shane, you and I could make here, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
What do you think would count? What types of what could be spent on to cause such an offending governmental agency maximum annoyance and disability? What would be some concrete examples, do you think?
Right. I've been talking to Ben Stone about this, but I think there's so many overlaps here with especially this portion and his book's edition, Subversion and Sabotage. And I think some of the examples he put forth in his book could definitely be applied here, whether it's, sabotage, whatever form of sabotage you want to use, sabotaging a government building, power grid. Like, there are a lot of things that you could do. And I feel kind of, not comfortable going into a lot of those details over in podcast form, but I guess those might be possibilities. It just depends upon how far you're willing to go. There would be ways. One other possibility is if you have $50,000 and you can pay a hacker on the deep web to take over a government agency website or something, and broadcast your message there. I suppose that would be a more passive, way to do it. For ideas on this sort of thing, retaliatory mechanisms or strategies, I think Sedition's version sabotage provides some very good, very very good maybe or maybe not, but some ideas to get your mind jogging on that. Because it would just depend how far are you willing to go, how much risk are you willing to take. What skills and strategies do you have available to you, or that you could outsource to somebody else? It kind of comes down to personal preference there, but I would point the listeners in the direction of that book, and you can find the audiobook and the PDF for that at libertyunderattack.com/Ben Stone audiobook. So that would be my answer to that question, Kyle.
Well, I've been reading a lot of comic books lately to kind of alleviate the pain of having to work in servile society. And one particular one that kind of focused on a more vigilante, although a lot of comic books are focused on vigilantism, if anybody was being really honest, is let's just say hypothetically the warden of the prison was engaged in some sort of corruption, and or even if it was something as mild as he was cheating on his, you know, a spouse or whatever. For those folks who may remember the Ashley Madison hack, where right, it was that yeah. one, what was it, the police captain or chief or whoever it was who blew his own brains out after that hack because his affairs, I think it was plural, were revealed or something to that effect. Yeah, so it's not completely, you know,
the problem solves itself.
the problem solves itself, and it doesn't count as blackmail because nothing's being withheld. It just goes public. There's no backdoor meetings. There's no, you know, pay me money or out. No, there's none of that. It's just, oh, you have some skeletons in your closet, and you're an authoritarian who's hurting a friend of mine. I think there's a solution here.
Yes, that's a very good you know, because you've got to imagine. Well, not even you got to imagine. I mean, enough of this stuff comes out, especially if it's the Illinois government that has your political prisoner friend or associate. I mean, there's plenty of stuff that you could drag out on politicians or bureaucrats that it could cause them serious harm. So I think that's a very interesting possibility too.
Yeah, and you know, it does not involve a case of lead poisoning, so to speak. So I mean, what I'm trying to say here is that in terms of retaliatory tactics or whatever, there's lots of different ways to skin a cat, so to speak. But yeah, let's kind of look at the rest of this quote here. So. Just to reiterate the point, so the avenging angel is contractually obliged to carry through, and the victim cannot stop it. That's more like the dead man's switch aspect of it, which I think is a good security measure personally.
It is. Like if they start happening, you know, if these sort of retaliatory measures start happening, and the victim gets intimidated by the state, you want to have that in the contractual agreement so that he can say, I cannot do anything about it. Like, he wants to have that kind of plausible deniability. What's he going to do next? I have no idea.
So let's imagine a hypothetical scene here, like a comic book almost. So let's say your political prisoner was hauled into the interrogation room again, but this time the Bludgies are not really happy with him in particular because his avenging angel has been, well, making their lives difficult. So all the political prisoner would have to say, and this is where the really excellent security culture comes into play, you know, plausible deniability and all that,
and
at least to some extent.
And the role-playing police interrogations beforehand, obviously.
Mm-hmm, of course. The political prisoner needs to say is like, look, even if I wanted to, even if you coerced me enough, I literally cannot stop said avenging angel from stopping because it's like a dead man switch. Sorry, you're on your own. I can't help you.
Either release me or have fun, I guess.
Right. Or that's the other thing. Leave me to rot in here. But the point is, even if I wanted to, even if you coerced me to at least try and stop the avenging angel, I literally can't. So that's kind of how that hypothetical later interrogation scenario would play out once the retaliation by the avenging angel is well underway. Is I like, oh, I'm a bludgy, I'm the police captain, I'm the warden, I'm the, you know, fill in title here, and you, Mr. Political Prisoner, you better tell your cohort to stop either releasing certain types of embarrassing information and or, to go with a little bit more of a guerrilla warfare example, shutting our lights off, so to speak. You better tell him. It's like, no, I can't tell him. Sorry. I mean, you can threaten to cut off my fingers or electrocute me or waterboard me or whatever, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques that the conservatives like to promote a lot, which is actually torture and a violation of the Eighth Amendment. But that's, of course, only if you care about legalities and constitutions and such. Yeah, I mean, you guys can torture me all you want. I literally cannot stop the avenging angel because it's once it kicks off, It's like a runaway train.
Until I'm released, it's just gonna happen. So,
or as Ray also mentioned too, if the individual should be executed, all the earmarked savings are so expended. So that's the other way around, right? Let's say the state, you know, they torture murder the guy. You know, let's hypothetically say the political prisoner in question is an older man. Already had pre-existing health problems, but then of course being in prison that exacerbates it, the stress, terrible conditions. There actually have been real world political prisoners, ladies and gentlemen, where they start, like, their feet start rotting and some other, you know, just because it's just unsanitary hellholes. And that's a discussion for another time. But suffice it to say, it's quite possible somebody could be tortured in prison and they just die just because it's just so extreme. So if the individual is executed, whether officially by the state or unofficially, like in their prison cell, because corruption and so forth, then yeah, all the earmarked savings by the avenging angel, the retaliations keep going until there's no more money, basically. So yeah, you're right.
Right, Shane. Right. And so, let's so again, and I want to make a note here before I forget. As far as the money, there shouldn't be any way that they'd be able to figure this out. But obviously, it says put it in a cache or a Swiss account, so like some sort of foreign bank account, make it inaccessible to the state. That's just kind of obvious, but I wanted to, you know, reiterate that point. You got to make sure the funds aren't accessible to, you know, the government that you're retaliating against.
Well, of course, and obviously you wouldn't want to, let's say the political prisoner before he was a political prisoner doesn't want to put his future avenging angel at risk should the political prisoner become a political prisoner, is incarcerated, et cetera, et cetera. And then the Bludgies are trying to track down the avenging angel once the retaliation starts, and they're trying to make him into a political prisoner as well. Obviously, there need to be some plausible deniability and good security culture and making sure there's not a way to for the Bludgies to actually locate, you know, it's
trace like, that money flow. Yeah.
Well, like their little, mnemonics go or whatever, identify, isolate, eliminate. Right. And they can't eliminate that which they cannot isolate, and they can't isolate those whom they can't even identify. So if they can't even identify the avenging angel or much of anybody else, so much for eliminating them. I mean, that's just kind of the bottom line here. I mean, people can talk about legalities and legal interstices. And yes, that was a season one episode as well. But when we're getting down to use of force issues or even what the Russians would call realpolitik, there are certain realities in a very utilitarian manner we have to consider, some of it technologically based, some of it not. So, yeah, I mean, so if the Bludgies can basically track down the money flow, you know, follow the money, right? Good old journalist advice. If they can follow the money to the avenging angel, then it's kind of a moot point, right? So the money trail has to be obscured between the future political prisoner and then his avenging angel. And I think that's kind of a key aspect, which is why Rayo said that the agreement is presumably kept secret in the first place. Okay. That's why he said that.
Exactly.
and do keep in mind, you know, regarding the notion of an avenging angel, okay, there is, and sorry, I should have made this point earlier. I'll do so now before I forget. There is no revolution here. At all. There's no let's do a collective movementism thing and we'll have the version on a theme of Che Guevara t-shirts with our strong man, fallacy or whatever. No. At worst, in some sense, this would basically be vigilantism. This would basically be a raw exercise of power by somebody not part of the establishment to directly attack the establishment in a very narrow circumstance. And not in the sense of we're going to do some grandstanding like we're a bunch of idiots on a mountaintop like Malheur or much of anywhere else or even that place in Nevada, you know, the bridge or whatever. No, this is actually we're going to hurt them because they've taken one of our people and we have the money to hurt them with because, again, Pavlovian psychology is applicable. And that's the real reason why is that you're trying to, quote, teach the bureaucrats to basically engage in real politic by saying like, well, yes, you know, XYZ, John Doe libertarian did violate our marijuana laws or whatever else. But because past experience show that whenever we mess with these people, we get avenging angels making us look bad and or basically slowly crippling our infrastructure that we need in order to rule well, then we shouldn't even touch those people because they'll bite back and bite hard.
And that's the key here. That's kind of the the end goal is, you know, have these become so frequent that anytime they get one of these libertarians, it happens, and eventually they just say, yeah, it's kind of like I guess maybe in some states where you know, the cops would arrest someone for like a marijuana law, and then some other law on the books, and then it would get you know, nullified every single time, or the judges wouldn't prosecute or charge anyone with it. So they just stopped essentially, you know, writing tickets for that law. So it's applicable, except obviously we're dealing with, you know, libertarians versus the state here, not the state versus the state.
Right. And let's one other thing I want to bring up before I forget. Maybe I should have brought it up earlier. The Avenging Angels and the fund they have access to. This is not the same as has been mentioned in other podcasts and other articles and such as legal defense funds. Right. Legal defense funds are concerned with legal interstices and playing games in court and going for jury nullification defenses and all of that kind of stuff. Being an avenging angel is basically 180 degrees the opposite of a legal defense fund, because now we're dealing with issues of power, use of force, at least to some extent, and then, of course, realpolitik. Remember, legal defense funds don't deal with any of that. Legal defense funds are all about interstices and, oh, can we make sure the due process of the political prisoner is respected and so forth.
And I guess one other point here, too, and that is a good distinction to make. But so could the political prisoner then, and I would imagine this would make it even, I guess it could go either way. Sure. But so there could be the Avenging Angel Fund. And then he could also have, you know, a legal defense fund for himself. If he does ever get you know, locked up, as any good, you know, arrest plan will have in it, some sort of you know, nest egg for that situation. So I wonder if he actually, you know, goes to court. Well, he'll have to go to court, and, you know, he tries to get off, because, you know, the objective is to get out of the cage, right? I suppose that these Avenging Angel, you know, attacks could either help or negatively affect maybe the sentencing there. But then again, the Avenging, you know, this agreement isn't, I guess, looking that far ahead. It's hey, you know, if they get me, you know, inflict some damage is kind of the idea. So what do you think, you know, in court? I personally think it could, depending upon the situation, it could have a positive or negative effect on the sentencing. You know, sometimes I think they might say, okay, you know, this isn't worth it. We're just going to, you know, let him go. And then other times they may say, you know, this is happening. You know, we can't tie you to it, but, you know, we're going for the maximum sentencing here.
At most, the Avenging Angel would only negatively affect the court case and the legalities and the lawfare of what the state's doing to that particular individual. Would only affect it if the cops can prove, or even loosely point the finger at, the political prisoner somehow being responsible for what the Avenging Angel is doing. If everything goes well, they won't even know there's a connection necessarily. Or let me put it this way. Remember in the quote, Rayo mentioned about that the agency and the individual bureaucrats would, however, be told for what they were being punished. He pointed out the victim was minding his own clear-cut principles. So if it was done right, they would just assume that the Avenging Angel is just some unrelated third party who got a little pissy about a specific political prisoner being hassled by the state, and not realize that there was a pre-existing agreement. Because remember,
right? So there'd be that plausible deniability, mm-hmm. and he could. I don't know what they're doing. I have no idea. I can't control what people do outside of here. I can't control mm-hmm. that. So I guess that yeah, that does make sense. Yeah.
And maybe you shouldn't prosecute. And maybe it kind of has a more subtle implied meaning. Yeah. Maybe if you guys weren't prosecuting me, then these Avenging Angels wouldn't be like shutting your lights off or. Basically causing other minor security, to get in a more guerrilla warfare context, causing minor security breaches in some of your other facilities that basically do involve processing prisoners of one type or another and so forth. And I don't know, maybe turning the water off, but not for the prisoners, but mainly like for like in the warden's private washroom or something, you know. So maybe some degree of sabotage in the classical sense, but not in the sense of like actively destroying something, but more in the sense of like a prank almost, you know, that causes, again, irritation, right? It's like Rayo said, maximum annoyance and disability, not like a World War II era, you know, basically like demolishing the Nazi you know, gas making plants necessarily with dynamite, but rather like, oh, the water shut off. I guess that could have been done with a guy with a wrench. Well, geez, that could have been anybody.
Right.
You know,
right.
it could have also not been an avenging angel, hypothetically, and could have been like a disgruntled maintenance guy that works at the prison or wherever, or the police station or where, or whatever the facility is, because there was some other office politics and he was passed over for a promotion as well. I mean, there are 20,000 other possibilities you just don't know. And so for the cops, the bludgies, or even the prosecutors to try and say, you political prisoner are somehow indescribably responsible for, you know, these retaliatory mechanisms, I think would be a bit of a stretch, okay, really, to try and pin it on them. And yeah, if everything goes well, then of course they wouldn't be able to tie the avenging angel to that particular political prisoner. And then of course the political prisoner, all he has to do is just feign ignorance. That's all he
exactly
has to do.
Yeah.
And then whatever happens to him in there, whether they make his life uncomfortable by, you know, not giving him enough blankets and yet it's like freezing cold in the cell, or they straight up torture him, because that happens too, by the way, even in these so-called American prisons, you know, as long as he basically just has the will to survive and keeps his damn mouth shut, he'll at least have a chance of seeing daylight again. And some of them won't, but there's always a chance, I suppose, even if it's 20, 30 years down the road, depending on what they're being, you know, slapped with.
Right. And yeah, might help their chances too. So
yeah,
it kind of depends upon the scenario. Who knows?
Yeah, you never know. You never know. I mean, I guess the only real downside, and before I forgot, I want to mention this too. The only real downside of the Avenging Angels is that, of course, this is going to cost money. You know, the more money that is saved up ahead of time and allocated to the Avenging Angels in question would mean that, you know, the longer and, dare shall I say, harder, perhaps in some ways more effective, the retaliatory mechanisms can be. Hypothetically, $2,000... you know, will go a lot longer than $100 will in retaliatory, all other factors being equal. That's probably the only real downside of it, as far as I can see. So I know some, you know, socialist types or syndicalists or whatever will kind of have their own critiques of that. But that aside, it's kind of like, okay, that's the only real bad side of it, is you just need money in order to do, or FERNs, the Federal Reserve notes. Because, of course, due to central banking, money might as well grow on trees. But that's a discussion for another time about economics and central banking and such. but yeah, it's kind of like, so aside from that one issue of the more ferns you have, the more you can have your avenging angel do for you on your behalf. $2,000 gets a lot more done than $100, so to speak. Other than that, what's the downside? It's like, oh, not much. So it's kind of like, okay. So and again, the idea is not to abolish the state. The idea is not even to fix corruption like some of the minarchists, the limited government people want to do. It's really more about
trying to get your guy free and or cause them as much annoyance and, as he said, disability for, you know, inconveniencing this libertarian, for locking him up.
Right, and in a direct and visceral way and all that, directly applying Pavlovian psychology. That's it. So, yeah, even, let's just say hypothetically, even if John Doe, political prisoner, even despite what his avenging angel does, the state is really going to keep him locked up for like 40, 50 years, or until he dies of other causes, you know, whichever happens first. Because people get shivved in prison all the time, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, but it would set the precedent. In not in a legal sense, but in a real politics sense, it would set the precedent that, well, the next time, you know, Dan bureaucrat decides to go after another libertarian for roughly the same thing, maybe he'll think twice because of what happened before, because the avenging angel for the other political prisoner who's still incarcerated, you know, managed to turn their lights on and off, and or embarrass the warden because he was some sort of he was bribing people, or who knows, maybe the warden was blackmailing other people over their cross-dressing hobbies that they didn't want to go public because they are like mainstream conservatives or whatever. I mean, you never know. There's 1,000 different ways this could play out. So that's kind of what I'm trying to get at here, ladies and gentlemen, is that the avenging angels have a lot of different applications that can be used to basically directly apply Pavlovian psychology. And I even would go to the degree and say force the bureaucrats to really not be so oppressive, at least to people like us. And that's
right.
Kind of
yeah. Spend, yeah. Spend your time, money and effort and resources on the controlled schizophrenics. Those in the safe survival society, leave us the hell alone. Or yeah, you see what happens kind of.
It's a form of self-defense, basically. Yeah. And if they're going to do their whole predatory, parasitic, status coercive nonsense, you know, victimize the people that support your servile society, right? I know that's not a very kind way of putting it, but it is very realistic. And it is very, even the utilitarian should agree with me on this one, it is very pragmatic. You know, you're going to parasitize, be parasitic and be predatory. Be predatory with your own people. Leave us the hell alone, because we don't even have a we don't even have a shared culture at all. Because that's an issue with the – again, for listeners, please see season one episode on the Servile Society. But yeah, I mean, we don't even have a shared culture. So how about you take your coercion and use it against somebody else who kind of has something at least roughly in common with you, with the Bludgies and so forth. Because of that, and that's kind of the problem with the Servile Society too, people in it, is that – they only dislike those portions of the system that threaten their own special interests, but they don't oppose the system conceptually and generally as a whole, because, you know, based on first principles of any kind.
Right, right.
It's very hackneyed and tailored to their own specific lifestyles and preferences and so forth. It's not any sort of principled stand. And so for those of us who at least try to take a principled stand, can we have some degree of protection? Can we have some degree of self-defense against the most vampiric entity that humanity has ever seen and probably will ever see, at least for quite some time? Can we at least do that much and force the state to at least be subjected to Pavlovian psychology? And that, I think, is where the avenging angels kind of make the difference.
Right, right. Yeah, that's... I don't really have much else to say there. I mean, it seems like an interesting strategy. It doesn't really seem like there's any negatives except for the financial aspect. You got to actually get that, you know, that money put away ahead of time. That seems to be the only real downside. I guess I'm just a little skeptical maybe about how effective the Pavlovian psychology would actually be. You know, if it would actually, you know, have a positive impact or not. But I guess we won't be able to know for sure until we actually see some case studies and how the state will react to such a scenario. But I really doubt. You know, say it's someone, say this is used in a scenario I mentioned a moment ago, like with some sort of Silk Road drug dealer or something. They're not gonna let that guy go. They're not going to. Like I'm almost positive. No matter what the avenging angel does, they're not gonna let him go.
No,
so I guess maybe as a way to prevent something like that in the future, possibly maybe, but I don't think it's gonna work too well in that scenario. It'd have to be something a lot less severe.
Yeah, and as we start to kind of conclude out here, let me just kind of reiterate something real quick. I wish people, and I've said this before in other articles and other podcasts and such, and I'll repeat it here a little bit. I wish people would stop spending so much time, money, and effort on legal defense funds, whether they be set up by so-called activists or just a generalized legal defense fund. I think something like an avenging angel is automatically much more promising, much more potentially efficacious and so forth than legal defense funds. And the reason being is because legal defense funds are focused on legal interstices and trying to use some degree of due process as some sort of shield against the government's use of lawfare against its own citizenry, which is very much touch and go. And even then, if we're talking strictly about odds, usually tends to be biased in favor of the state rather than the other way around. That's kind of how I kind of view things. And the nice thing about the avenging angel approach to it is that it completely just sidesteps the playing games of interstices. It completely sidesteps and it gets down to issues of power and force and even psychology. But it's really real politics. It directly applies what is known about real politic and is forcing the state to behave in a way that Yeah, I mean, so even if, let's say, the Bludgies really were let's assume for a minute that they really are acting in accordance with the law, and let's say some libertarian really was committing civil disobedience and really did do what they're accusing him of and so forth, and they really are trying to quote-unquote enforce the law and all that, that doesn't matter. They're not going to enforce the law if they've got avenging angels. Excuse me. If they have avenging angels who are pretty much going to, depending how far they take it, pretty much almost demolish an entire police department in one sense or another and put them out of work. Or let me put it this way. You know how, as a side note, there was actually a big news trend a couple of years ago about how a lot of the police pensions were at risk of being confiscated or otherwise liquidated by the banksters. That's an avenue I don't think a lot of people really think about. Is because, I mean, even the Bludgies with their pensions are quite vulnerable. So I think potential...
If an avenging angel starts going after, you know, pensions, oh man, will hell break loose.
Yeah, and again, I would not suggest that as a first strike retaliation because that's quite severe, but on the scale of use of force... yeah, it's definitely on the scale to go directly after those pensions and either liquidate them or actually probably better is redirect them to something a little bit more, you know, valuable. And that can come down to personal preference depending on how you siphon the funds away and so forth. I mean, all of that's, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the police pensions are basically financed by taxes, right? Or otherwise by coercive means.
That's how they would have to be funded, right? If it's a, you know, that's how they you know get their money. So yeah, it has to be publicly funded.
Yeah, so I mean it just, I mean, it's kind of like the old joke about is it a crime to steal stolen money? You know, it's just kind of like, I mean, the property rights in question have been so thoroughly violated that unless you're going to try and maybe perform some form of restitution, it's almost impossible. So at that point, you might as well, if you're a vigilante. Basically kind of like what the fictional Frank Castle does, where he takes on gang members and he just mows them down, and then he takes their guns and their drugs and their weapons, and he uses it to, in a very guerrilla warfare style, because he was a former soldier, basically uses it to strengthen himself, and then he goes after another gang, you know, the Italian mob one week and then the Irish mob the next, and he kills them and then takes their drugs and weapons and money, and then uses that to strengthen himself, and then it's wash, rinse, repeat, right? Now, instead of gang members, just, you know, apply it to, well, like Murray Rothbard said, you know, it's the, how do you put it? It was the largest, the bandit gang writ large.
Yep.
What
yep.
The state
bandit
is.
Bandit gang writ large. Yep.
Yeah. So just take the Frank Castle, the fictional Frank Castle method and just apply it to the state. You know, I think the avenging angels can get a lot of inspiration from comic books. Some types for at least hypotheticals and fiction. And then if they, depending on their risk tolerance and depending on circumstances, they might want to, you know, adapt it to their own, whatever they're trying to do, and see if maybe they can have a little bit of creativity and try and figure out how they can help their political prisoners and so forth, or whomever else. And that's the other thing. It doesn't have to be a political prisoner. It could just be somebody being harassed by the state, but not necessarily in a concrete box. You know, it could just be somebody who's being harassed, like if it's a tax issue. A lot of those people are not in, don't get the cuffs slapped on them. People who are victimized by civil asset forfeiture, by definition, they're innocent owners, but the state's basically trying to steal their property. You know, there's there's also all the various illegitimate eminent domain cases that pop up over the decades and so forth. I mean, there's 1,001 ways that avenging angels can basically help truly innocent people who are being victimized by the state and basically try to force the bureaucrats to just back off.
Right. And I will, you know, let the listeners know again for this episode right here, for the Vonnie podcast and for the next one on Liberty Under Attack this coming week, you know, Ben Stone's book, you know, could provide you with a lot of interesting ideas. Again, libertyunderattack.com/Ben Stone audiobook for obviously the audiobook as well as the free PDF. So yeah, like that book now, like I'm thinking about it again after reading it, or I've read it a couple of times, and a lot of scenarios he lays out could be, you know, very useful to an avenging angel, or in this next LUA episode, vigilantism, or, you know, assassination markets or whatever. So very interesting stuff, for sure.
Well, do you have any closing thoughts, Shane, concerning the Avenging Angels and how they might be relevant to trying to increase one's invulnerability to coercion?
Well, as far as reducing someone's vulnerability to coercion, I think the way that I see that it's possible is if the Pavlovian psychology actually kind of works, then it could be very, very helpful in keeping people out of government dungeons or the various other scenarios that she laid out where it could be applied. I think that's really an interesting way. Beyond that, this is one of those things where you're actually if the political prisoner is already in a cage, so he's already as invulnerable to coercion as he can be. Now for the Avenging Angel. He or she is in a little bit of a worse position, a little more vulnerable. Not that he or she has to be. If they practice security culture well and everything is laid out ahead of time the right way. But this is one of those things where it could possibly make you more vulnerable to coercion if you are the Avenging Angel. So I guess that's something kind of to leave the listeners with, just as kind of a thought.
Well, as far as the risk issue goes, I mean, obviously we've covered agorism in previous episodes. Agorism has risks, and you kind of choose your own level of risk, right? I mean, not everybody wants to do black market activity. Some people want to limit themselves to the gray market, right? And there are other people that don't want to do completely black market activities because that's about as risky as it gets. They want to do a mixture of gray and black market activities, and even whatever black market activities they're doing would be something more along the lines of pot deals, not weapon sales of like fully automatic whatever the heck, right? Or anything more boom to boom boom, so to speak. People choose their own level of risk,
right?
And I think with the Avenging Angels, I think there's kind of something similar there too, right? So it's not completely crazy that there would be some Venuans who would prefer never to be an Avenging Angel because they're just not comfortable with even the loosest possibility of whatever potential risk, especially if the money trail could be followed or whatever. But I think there's other Venuans who if they're already doing ethical enclave trading, how much more riskier is being an Avenging Angel if you're already doing the ethical enclave?
And that could be a very bustling business for an ethical enclavist or an agorist. Is actually like set up kind of, I guess it could be some sort of like an Avenging Angel insurance agency or something. Like you pay, $100 a month into it, and any of their clients, if they ever get, tossed in a government dungeon, then they'll be the one to kind of carry that out. That probably wouldn't be the best way to model it. Maybe some sort of decentralized sort of organization. I think Ben Stone called it a committee of vigilance, committee of vigilantes. That might be a very interesting, business endeavor for anyone who might be interested.
Well, at that point, you're kind of leering into the notion of an assassination market at that point, at least in some sense,
it very well could. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Even if the particular activities are not actual assassinations, it's still the notion of assassination.
And the agreements could be on the some sort of crypto notes blockchain technology. So it can be encrypted, and it could be there's so many options for this blockchain technology, man.
Well, obviously, the contracts, in order to remain secret, if you're going to do it digitally, have to be encrypted, of course. I mean, I guess there's also going the low tech route and keeping it to paper and pencil, or even just a sincere gentleman's agreement if the parties are trustworthy and so forth, I guess. But of course, there's money involved, so I would assume that the future political prisoner and then his Avenging Angel, I would assume, want some sort of like slightly more formal written contract, at least to some extent. But of course, because it's a secret contract, there has to be other other protections at play too, right, to prevent fraud. I mean, not only that, but think about this. I mean, I know there have been some agorists who have mentioned about the use of like escrow accounts and similar things to kind of serve as like a friendly third party to make sure that the two contracting parties actually fulfill their sides of the contract and so forth. So it wouldn't be completely outside the realm of possibility that maybe a potential political prisoner could have his Avenging Angel fund in the form of escrow, and then as the Avenging Angel carries out the retaliation, the escrow releases the funds in like certain amounts or whatever.
Right,
depending
yeah.
d- depending who's managing the escrow and whoever that third party is. Now, I guess the only downside of that is that who's ever managing the escrow,
they have knowledge of it, and that's another person that the state could go after. And then beyond that, I mean, yeah, that I like the decentralized kind of peer to peer aspect better. Only the two people know about it, rather than the two people and the person that's escrowing. So it's an interesting idea, and I'm sure there's some way it could be worked out. But as far as, you know, trying to make this idea as invulnerable to coercion as possible, then I mean, yeah, that'd kind of be the downside there.
Yeah, I agree with you as far as like what some agorists want to do with like reliable like third parties or whatever. And you know as the Agora is developed, then yeah, I guess there could be a potential market for that. But considering that, you know, it's late 2017, I think a more peer-to-peer approach for now is definitely more of the right way to go. It's the one that's the most secure, you know, the least number of failure points, I think was what some, you know, IT techs would phrase it as and so forth. And I think you're right about that. And besides, you know, considering the nature of the contract and what's at stake and all that, I would assume that the parties in play would not be wanting to commit fraud, right? Like some sort of con man pretending to be an avenging angel just to con the other guy out of his money and then not spend the money as part of retaliation and instead go vacationing in the Bahamas or wherever, or in Bora Bora.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I know some people might have some concerns about that, but honestly, it's like you should only. But, you know, considering the extent of this and the very specialized nature of what this kind of activity is, you should only be dealing with people you trust anyway, you know.
Right. Yeah, that shouldn't even be. Yeah, that you should. I mean, for me, I wouldn't be considering making such an agreement unless I trusted someone you know, that well. So yeah, I mean the trust thing. Yeah, I don't think you know that there's too much of a risk of fraud, or anything like that with this agreement, just because the details involved and kind of the. You know, what would be happening. Yeah, it's got to be someone you trust that can actually, you know, carry this out and that, you know, won't screw you over. So,
sure, of course. And of course, obviously, if there needs to be some more fleshing out of this, I guess there's always season three for that. But I think for now, and tentatively, and considering what Rhea was kind of getting at with the notion of avenging angels, I think if I had to speculate, Shane, he was trying to think of a way of could there be like a type of guardian for Venuans who happen to get, you know, thrown in the big house. Is there some sort of retaliatory means that are not of a revolutionary nature? And I think his kind of notion of vigilantism, where it's basically financed by the victim but not directly controlled by the victim, I think is, you know, kind of the right way to go.
Yeah, I agree.
So, any other thoughts before we close out?
No, that's all I've got.
Alrighty then. So, as was mentioned at the beginning of this episode, part two of this discussion can be found on Liberty Under Attack Radio this coming Sunday. Just visit the website, libertyunderattack.com, or find the podcast on your favorite podcatcher. We will expand far beyond what we talked about this evening. The website is vanupodcast.com. If you value the work put into this podcast, please consider leaving us a donation. vanupodcast.com/donate. And we are a crypto preferred podcast. That's all we have for you. We hope to see you Sunday over on the LUA Radio podcast feed.